that the incredulous nation in any wise comprehended the true spirit of the raid or of its commander. Fortunate for his memory, fortunate for the brave man associated with him, fortunate for the truth of history, John Brown survived the saber gashes, bayonet wounds, and bullet holes, and was able, though covered with blood, to tell his own story and make his own defense. Had he, with all his men, as might have been the case, gone down in the shock of battle, the world would have no true basis for its judgment in one of the most heroic efforts ever witnessed in behalf of liberty would have been confounded with base and selfish purposes. When, like savages, the Wises, the Vallandighams, the Washingtons, the Stuarts, and there stood around the fallen and bleeding hero and sought by torturing questions to wring from his supposed dying lips some words by which to soil the sublime undertaking by implicating Gerrit Smith, Joshua R. Giddings, Dr. S. G. Howe, G. L. Stearns, Edwin Morton, Frank Sanborn, and other prominent anti-slavery men, the brave old man not only avowed his object to be the emancipation of the slaves, but severely and proudly announced himself as the solely responsible for all that had happened. Though some thought of his own life might at such moment might have seemed natural and excusable, he showed none and scornfully rejected the idea that he acted as an agent or an instrument of any man or set of men. He admitted that he had friends and sympathizers, but to his own head he invited all the bolts of slaveholding wrath and fury and welcomed them to do their worst. His manly courage and self-forgetful nobleness were not lost upon the crowd about him, nor upon the country. They drew applause from his bitterest enemies. Said Henry A. Wise, "He is the gamest man I ever met." He was kind and humane to his prisoners, said Colonel Lewis Washington. To the outward eye of men, John Brown was a criminal, but to their inward eye, he was a just man and true. His deeds might be disowned, but the spirit which made those deeds possible was worthy of the highest honor. It's been often asked, why did not Virginia spare the life of this man? Why did she not avail herself of this grand opportunity to add to her other glory, that of a lofty magnanimity? Had they spared the good old man's life, had they said to him, "You see, we have you in our power and could easily take your life, but we have no desire to hurt you in any way. You have committed a terrible crime against society. You have invaded us at midnight and attacked a sleeping community, but we recognize you as a lunatic, as a fanatic, and in some sense instigated by others. And on this ground and others, we release you. Go about your business and tell those who sent you that we can afford to be magnanimous to our enemies." I say, had Virginia held some such language as this to Brown, they would have inflicted a heavy blow on the whole Northern abolition movement, one which only the omnipotence of truth and the force of truth could have overcome. I have no doubt Governor Wise would have done so gladly, but alas, he was the executive of a state which thought she could not afford such magnanimity. She had that within her bosom which could more safely tolerate the presence of a criminal than a saint, a highway robber than a moral hero. All her hills and valleys were studded with material for a disastrous conflagration, and one spark of the dauntless spirit of Brown might set the whole state in flames. A sense of this appalling liability put an end to every noble consideration. His death was a foregone conclusion, and his trial was simply one of them. Honor to the brave young Colonel Hoyt, who hastened from Massachusetts to defend his friend's life at the peril of his own. But there would have been no hope of success had he been allowed to plead the case. He might have surpassed Choate or Webster in power. 1,000 physicians might have sworn that Captain Brown was insane. It would have been all to no purpose. Neither eloquence nor testimony could have prevailed. Slavery was the idol of Virginia, and pardon and life to Brown meant condemnation and death to slavery. He had practically illustrated a truth stranger than fiction, a truth higher than Virginia had ever known, a truth more noble and beautiful than Jefferson ever wrote. He had evinced a conception of the sacredness and value of liberty which transcended in sublimity that of her own Patrick Henry, and made even his fire-flashing sentiments of liberty or death seem dark and tame and selfish. Henry loved liberty for himself, but this man loved liberty for all men, and for those most despised and scorned, as well as for those most esteemed and honored. Just here was the true glory of John Brown's mission. It was not for his own freedom that he was thus ready to lay down his life. For with Paul he could say, "I was born free." No chain had bound his ankle, no yoke had galled his neck. History has no better illustration of pure, disinterested benevolence. It was not Caucasian for Caucasian, white man for white, not rich man for rich man, but Caucasian for Ethiopian, white man for black man, rich man for poor man. The man admitted and respected for the man despised and rejected. "I want you to understand, gentlemen," he said to his persecutors, "that I respect the rights of the poorest and weakest of the colored people oppressed by the slave system as I do those of the most wealthy and powerful. In this we have the key to the whole life and career of the man. With the Allegheny Mountains for his pulpit, the country for his church, and the whole civilized world for his audience, he was 1,000 times more effective as a preacher than as a warrior. And the consciousness of this fact was the secret of his amazing complacency. Might with the sword of steel, he was mightier with the sword of truth. And with this sword, he literally swept the horizon. He was more than a match for all the wisest masons for Landinghams in Washington who could rise against him. They could kill him, but they could not answer him." Most of us can remember some event or incident which at some time has come to us and made itself a permanent part of our lives. Such an incident came to me in the year 1847. I had then the honor of spending a day and night under the roof of a man whose character and conversation made a very deep impression on my mind and heart. And as the circumstance does not lie entirely out of our present observations, you will pardon for a moment a seeming digression. The name of the person alluded to had been several times mentioned to me in a tone that made me curious to see him and make his acquaintance. He was a merchant, and our first meeting was at his store, a substantial brick building giving evidence of a flourishing business. After a few minutes' detention, long enough for me to observe the neatness and order of the place, I was conducted by him to his residence, where I was kindly received by his family as an expected guest. I was a little disappointed at the appearance of this man's house, for after seeing his fine store, I was prepared to see a fine resident. But this logic was entirely contradicted by the facts. The house was a small wooden one on a black street in a neighborhood of laboring men and mechanics, respectful enough, but not just the spot where one would expect enough, but not just the spot where one would expect to find the home of a successful merchant. Plain as was the outside, the inside was plainer. Its furniture might have pleased a Spartan. It would take longer to tell what was not in it than what was. No sofas, no cushions, no curtains, no carpets, no easy rocking chairs invited to innovation of rest or repose. My first meal passed under the misnomer of tea. It was none of your tea and toast sort, but potatoes and cabbage and beef soup. Such a meal as a man might relish after following the plow all day, or after performing a forced march of a dozen miles over rough ground in frosty weather. Innocent of point of paint, veneering, varnish, or a tablecloth, the table announced itself unmistakably and honestly pine and of the plainest workmanship. No hired help passed from kitchen to dining room, serving, starting in amazement at the colored man at the white man's table. The mother, daughters, and son did the serving and did it well. I heard no apology for doing their own work. They went through it as if used to it, untouched by any thought of degradation or impropriety. Supper over, the boys helped to clear the table and wash the dishes. This style of housekeeping struck me as a little odd. Such a man, whose name I heard uttered in whispers, such was the house in which he lived. Such were family and household management, and such was Captain John Brown. He said to me at this meeting that he had invited me to his house for the special purpose of laying before me his plan for the speedy emancipation of my race. He seemed to apprehend opposition on my part as he opened the subject and touched my vanity by saying that he had observed my course at home and abroad and wanted my cooperation. He said he had been here for the last 30 years looking for colored men to whom he could safely reveal his secret and had almost despaired at times of finding such, but that now he was encouraged, for he saw heads rising up in all directions to whom he thought he could safely impart his plan. As this plan then lay in his mind, it was very simple and had much to commend it. It did not, as was supposed by many, contemplate a general rising among the slaves and a general slaughter of the slave masters for insurrection. Insurrection, he thought, would only defeat the object. But it did contemplate the creating of an armed force which should act in the very heart of the South. He was not averse to the shedding of blood, and thought the practice of carrying arms would be a good one for the colored people to adopt, as it would give them a sense of manhood. No people, he said, could have self-respect or be respected who would not fight for their freedom. He called my attention to a large map of the United States and pointed out to me the far-reaching Alleghenies stretching away from the borders of New York into the southern states. These mountains, he said, are the heart and basis of my plan. God has given the strength of these hills to freedom. They were placed here to aid the emancipation of your race. They are full of natural forts where one man for defense would be equal to 100 for attack. They're full of good hiding places where a large number of men could be concealed and baffle and elude pursuit for a long time. I know these mountains well and could take a body of men into them and keep them there in spite of all the efforts of Virginia to dislodge me and drive me out. The trouble was to get the right men to start with and money enough to equip them. He had adopted the simple and economic mode of living to which I have referred with the view to save money for this purpose. This was said in no boastful tone, for he felt that he had delayed already too long and had no room to boast either his zeal or his self-denial. From 8 o'clock in the evening to 3 a.m. in the morning, Captain Brown and I sat face to face, he arguing in favor of his plan and I finding all the objections I could argue against it. Now, Mark, this meeting of ours was a full 12 years before the strike at Harper's Ferry. He had been watching and waiting all that time for suitable heads to rise and pop up, as he said, among the sable millions in whom he could confide. Hence, 40 years had passed between his thought and his act. 2 weeks prior to the meditated attack, Captain Brown summoned me to meet him at an old stone quarry at the river near the town of Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. His arms and ammunition were stored in that town and were to be moved on to Harper's Ferry. In company with Shields Green, I obeyed the summons, and prompt to the hour we met the dear old man with Kagi, his secretary, the appointed place. Our meeting was in some sense a council of war. We spent the Saturday and succeeding Sunday in conference on the question whether the desperate step should be taken or the old plan, as already described, should be carried out. He was for boldly striking Harper's Ferry at once and running the risk of getting into the mountains afterwards. I was for avoiding Harper's Ferry altogether. Shields Green and Mr. Kagi remained silent listeners throughout. It is needless to repeat here what was said after what had happened. Suffice it that after all I could say, I saw that my old friend had resolved on his course, and it was idle to parley. I told him finally that it was impossible for me to join him. I could see Harper's Ferry only as a trap of steel and ourselves on the wrong side of it. He regretted my decision, and we parted. If a monument should be erected to the memory of John Brown, as there ought to be, the form and name of Shields Green should have a conspicuous place upon it. It is a remarkable fact that in this small company of men, one alone showed any sign of weakness or regret for what he did or attempted to do. Poor Cook broke down and sought to save his life by representing that he had been deceived and allured by false promises. But Stevens, Hazlitt, and Green went to their doom like the heroes they were, without a murmur, without a regret, believing alike in their captain and in their cause. For the disastrous termination of this invasion, several causes have been assigned. It has been said that Captain Brown found it necessary to strike before he was ready, that men had promised to join him from the north who failed to arrive, that the cowardly Negroes did not rally to his support as he expected, but the true cause, as stated by himself, contradicts all these theories, and from his statement, there is no appeal. Among the questions put to him by Mr. Van Landingham after his capture was the following. Did you expect a general uprising of the slaves in case of your success? To this he answered, no, sir, nor did I wish it. I expected to gather enough from time to time and then to set them free. Did you expect to hold possession here until then? Answer, well, probably I had quite a different idea. I do not know as I ought to reveal my plan. I am here, wounded, and a prisoner, because I foolishly permitted myself to be so. You overstate your strength when you suppose I could have taken if I had allowed it. I could have been taken if I had allowed it. I was too tardy after commencing the opening attack and delaying any movements through Monday night and up to the time of the arrival of the government troops. It was all because of my desire to spare the feelings of my prisoners and their families. But the question is, did John Brown fail? He certainly did fail to get out of Harper's Ferry before being beaten down by the United States soldiers. He did fail to save his own life and to lead a liberating army into the mountains of Virginia. But did he not go to Harper's Ferry to save his life? But he did not go to Harper's Ferry to save his life. The true question is, did John Brown draw his sword against slavery and thereby lose his life in vain? And to this I answer 10,000 times, no. No man fails or can fail who so grandly gives himself and all he has to a righteous cause. No man who in his hour of extremest need went on his way to meet an ignominious death could so forget himself as to stop and kiss a little child. One of the hated race for whom he was about to die could by any possibility fail. Did John Brown fail? Ask Henry A. Wise, in whose house less than 2 years after a school for the emancipated slaves was taught. Did John Brown fail? Ask James M. Mason, the author of the Inhuman Fugitive Slave Bill, who was cooped up in Fort Warren as a traitor less than 2 years from the time that he stood over the prostrate body of John Brown. Did John Brown fail? Ask Clemming C. Vallandigham, one other of the inquisitorial party, for he too went down to the tremendous whirlpool created by the powerful hand of this bold invader. If John Brown did not end the war that ended slavery, he did at least begin the war that ended slavery. If we look over the dates, places, and men for whom this honor is claimed, we shall find that not Carolina, but Virginia, not Fort Sumter, but Harper's Ferry in the arsenal, not Colonel Anderson, but John Brown began the war that ended American slavery and made this a free republic. Until this blow was struck, the prospect for freedom was dim, shadowy, and uncertain. The irrepressible conflict was one of words, votes, and compromises. When John Brown stretched forth his arm, the sky was cleared. The time for compromises was gone. The hosts of freedom, armed, stood face to face over the chasm of a broken Union, and the clash of arms was at hand. The South staked all upon getting possession of the federal government, and failing to do that, drew the sword of rebellion, and thus made her own, and not Brown's, the best cause, the lost cause of the century. The lost cause of the century.